Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkran, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Amelia Bachrock, who is Assistant Professor of Religion and Gender, also in the Department of Gender, Sexuality, and Feminist Studies at Oberlin. We will be speaking about her fascinating and beautifully illustrated 2019 map and publication, In the Service of Krishna. Amelia, welcome to the podcast.
Raj, it's really wonderful to be here. Thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. And you know, this is the first time we're having darshana, albeit sort of, you know, e-darshana, but it's not our first rodeo, as they say. We were on a panel. I think
yes.
We were on a panel or something that I organized at some point.
Now many years ago, but it seems like yesterday in Toronto, I believe. The AAS.
Yeah,
yes.
Or something, or maybe the 2016. Oh, you know what? San Antonio. The Sonality panel.
Okay, yes, you're right. You know, all the years blend together, but it's really good.
All the years blend together, all the events blend together.
Yes.
But I think we have corresponded by email, but it must have been 5 years ago, but we've never really seen each other, so it's interesting. All roads lead to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast, apparently.
I love that, and it's really good to be here. A good road to be on.
Great. Since we've already started talking about the AR without even trying to, I might as well point listeners to the fact that this podcast is one of three podcasts that pertains to a really interesting panel at this year, 2021's meeting of the American Academy of Religion. It's always in November. This year, it also happens to be in San Antonio again. And the panel is called New Books in Hindu Studies, which happens to be the former name of this podcast. There will be two pairs of books being compared. We had Shankar Nair come on recently about translating wisdom. That will be discussed in tandem with Patton Burchin's A Genealogy of Devotion. We also have Vijaya Nagarajan's Feeding 1,000 Souls, just had her on. That'll be discussed in tandem with Leah Como's book. And Amelia happens to be the chair of that panel.
Yeah.
Have I lied? Is that true?
No, that is exactly right. Yeah, I am the chair. Really excited to host these books. The roundtable, as it has in the past, I think now this is our third year, maybe second even. It's relatively new. As Raj said, it highlights these four fantastic books with the aim of exposing scholars to the new theoretical interventions that these scholars make, but also to give, which is unique, I think, concrete ideas about how to incorporate those interventions into our pedagogies as scholars. So people, the two pairs will both sort of discuss the intellectual interventions and the content, but also how to teach these books, both to undergraduates and graduates, which I think is really exciting part of the panel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Really love that. Really love that. And obviously hope to check it out. You know, whether podcasting or publishing, you know, for me in the back of my brain, it's sort of a form of teaching, kind of sharing what we're doing to various audiences. And I have to ask, is it coincidence that that initiative was called New Books in Hindu Studies?
You know,
is it at all?
That is a good question. I am new, relatively new to the the steering committee of that unit, the Hindu Studies unit. So that's a good question. It might be coincidence, but it seems to convene perfectly. So it's really nice to showcase that.
Sure. Yeah. And this is why I was happy to sort of, as soon as I saw there was a New Books in Hindu Studies, mind you, I think I had just rebranded the podcast to New Books in Indian Religions at that point to make space, but also to make space for exactly folks like Shankar's work, right? Like,
Who's
on the panel.
Right.
So I'm like, okay, you've got a New Books in Hindu Studies panel going on. We might as well do a series. And then once I approached the co-chairs of the Hinduism unit, Harshita and Dhyani, I realize that half of you, we already have interviews for, so it wouldn't take too much to get the other half of you on here. Perfect.
It's wonderful. Yeah.
Enough yammering on about the AAR and the panel. Let's get to the good stuff. What's your book about?
So this is a book that really highlights a distinct, unique manuscript, which comes from the Pushti Margi Hindu community. And this manuscript is illustrated, which itself is not so unique for I'll talk a little bit about the dating, but the colophon, the dating of the text itself is 1702. It's right there in the title. And the manuscript contains these very popular sacred life stories, hagiographies is one word for them, of the founders of the Pushti Margi Hindu community and their disciples of the 16th century, and really importantly, the relationship that these people have to the popular Hindu deity Krishna. So the book highlights the stories that are told far beyond this manuscript, but specific to this particular manuscript, importantly in relationship to these really unique and beautiful illustrations. Again, illustrated manuscripts of this period aren't so unique in and of themselves, but these particular set of stories, really, we don't have illustrations that correspond to them. So the book really presents the sort of the nuances of these relationships as they are envisioned both in text and in painting.
The book, I mean, this is the medium of sound, arguably divine in terms of anything Indic. Having said that, the book is full of just gorgeous images, like really and truly. And so it's sort of the love child of a scholarly book and a coffee table book in many ways, it
yes,
seems.
That's right. That's exactly right. That's what we've said. Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah. It is that.
Mm-hmm. How did this project come about for you?
That's a great question. Really, it's been a true collaboration with the artist, art collector, and art historian Amit Ambalal, who's based in Ahmedabad, Gujarat, which is the same city that I had have been living in to study Gujarati language and to do both doctoral and postdoctoral studies between about 2009 and 2017 regularly. My research was and remains focused on the ways that this contemporary Pushti Margi community in based in Gujarat reads and interprets this particular body of literature, this body of hagiographies written in Old Hindi, also known as Braj Bhasha, this particular type of Old Hindi. And so I was introduced to Amit after he'd given a talk on his own work on pre-modern Pushti Margi paintings. We struck up this conversation about the relationship between visual and literary arts. And he was really interested on my work in the hagiographies, which, as I said, tell these sacred life stories of the Pushti Margi's preceptors, their disciples. He was really interested because he had this recently, back in 2009, he'd acquired this very unique manuscript, of course, the focus of this book. And being the very generous human that he is, he invited me to his home, his private collection, to spend time with this manuscript. And I had spent time with manuscripts before, but not one quite as special as this. So really through this mutual excitement that we had about pictures that tell stories, this phrase that sort of kept coming up again and again, we decided that we really should share this collection with the public through a really image-centered publication. So it came out of a collaboration with him. Yeah.
And you certainly have in this book. The subtitle is not a misnomer. It's the subtitle is Illustrating the Lives of 84 Vaishnavas mm-hmm. from a 1702 manuscript. Mm-hmm. I'm both excited and envious that you have something like a precise year like 1702. It's like maybe Mahatma, 4th century, 8th
right,
century.
Right, we're not right, sure. Right.
Could you say a bit to a broader audience? There may as well be listeners who are on this path or certainly cognizant of this path, and there may be some who are not quite aware of this path. Say a little bit about the historical context.
Yeah, the historical context. These stories likely circulated, these hagiographies likely circulated really long before they were committed to writing. And I'll say more about the colophon and the dating of this manuscript in a moment. But they likely circulated orally. And in fact, that sort of oral quality and oral residue, if you will, is really embedded in the written texts. But we know that in the 17th century, because we have manuscripts that predate this one, our earliest dated to 1640 CE, we know that they were committed to writing. In the 17th century, even if they had circulated orally for a long time. The Vallabhacharya, who is the first preceptor, the first guru, the first Goswami, these are all different terms used for the hereditary leaders of this community. He lived in the 16th century. His death date is usually dated 1530 or 1531. He inspired through his Vaishnava teachings, his devotion to Krishna, what is known as the Pushti Marg, the Path of Grace, a tradition that focuses heavily on the intimate, cultivating the intimate relationships with this deity Krishna, a playful childhood, childlike, I should say, deity in many of his iterations through ritual practices known as seva. Seva can be translated as loving service, but a sort of set of ritual practices that we can talk a bit more about later that he sort of inspired through his teachings and exegesis on various popular texts. So the people who came into the fold, so to speak, inspired by these teachings and by this practice of seva, those are the Vaishnavas, the 84 Vaishnavas whose stories are told here. And of course, I say this in the introduction, but there are in fact many, many more than 84 people whose stories are told here. Sometimes whole families get sort of lumped under one name in the text. But these are the folks whose stories are narrated. And of course, we learn a lot about Vallabhacharya, this first preceptor of the Pushti Marg, and his family as well. But perhaps unique to this this type of literature is that the hagiographies are not focused solely on the hereditary leaders, on the saint, so to speak, himself, but really on his disciples. So it's a unique set of stories.
Do you maybe want to dive into that point about the dating that you wanted to make?
Yes, and right. So the dating, you asked about the manuscript. So yes, you say you're envious of this date. Well, dates are sticky things. And so even if the colophon itself tells us that the scribe at that moment said, hey, this is Vikram Samavat, 1758, I think, right, which we've translated to 1702. It's quite clear from my time with the manuscript from Amit Ambalal's and others that it actually is a manuscript that has been compiled over centuries, really, or at least decades. Centuries. So it might have been a date that was the date that the scribe was basing the manuscript on from another manuscript. We do know that the oldest parts of the manuscript could have come from 1702. The paintings themselves, however, are likely 19th century paintings, and we know this by the style of the paintings. So some of the pages of the manuscript have been renumbered, and you can actually see that in some of the images we've included in the book. So it's really this sort of piecemeal, yet in the end, complete manuscript with all of the stories that one would expect from this this particular text, right? It corresponds to other manuscripts and then later printed editions. So we have a clear date, yes, but we're not exactly sure if it represents the entire text. Right? It's more complicated.
Well, if there was an ambiguity about authorship or dates, it certainly wouldn't be of South Asia, would it?
right.
This is not dissimilar. Not dissimilar to my eyes to sort of, put on as process in various mm-hmm. manuscripts and mm-hmm. then arriving in a critical edition. It seems that maybe you are closer to or you have manuscripts intact that you're using rather than them having to be critically edited.
That's correct. Right.
Could you say a word? We'll dive into the book in more closer detail in a moment. Could you say a word about maybe the life of the text, sort of the world in front of the text, or how we know a little bit about the world behind the text?
Yeah.
Now, how is this used today, if at all?
Oh, wonderful. This very much connects to my broader research, which is to study how these stories and this the Chorasi Vaishnavanki Varta, right? The sort of the Vartas, this word can be translated in different ways, the hagiographies, the chronicles, the stories of these 84 Vaishnavas. It's sort of one collection of Vartas. There are others in this Pushti Margi tradition. Many of them, but particularly this text, these stories, I should say, are read and used in people's everyday ritual practices in Gujarat and beyond. Much of my broader research has been based on spending time with folks who read these stories virtually, very often in satsang, that is in sort of community together, right? In gatherings of the faithful, if you will, enjoy. I mean, there's so much enjoyment in these stories. They are, of course, are didactic. They teach about the history of the community. They offer this, I think I have this term that came up sort of in conversation with Vaishnavas themselves, of course, vicarious epiphany. They offer people a chance to sort of engage with these great devotees of the past and how they encountered Krishna. They also give sort of lessons on how to perform seva, even though that seva, that ritual practice, is very different often in certain ways in people's contemporary lives today, right, than the 16th century, as the stories are sort of based in that pre-modern context. They offer all these different things to readers. So what do people do? They read and discuss them. They talk about how the stories influence and can teach them in their own lives today. So they're very much alive, very much living texts.
Yes, there was a. I'm glad I asked that question. Always naive questions, right? Amelia has a forthcoming monograph, I believe, called Religious Reading in Everyday Lives in Pushti Margi Hinduism, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right.
That monograph will foreground sort of the life of the text, the world in front of the text.
That's exactly right, yeah.
Perfect. Exactly so right. We know a bit about the world behind the text. Mm-hmm. We know a bit about the world in front of the text. Mm-hmm. And now let's dive into the world within the text. And
yes.
A good way to frame that is, how is the book structured?
This book itself, yes. My book, In the Service of Krishna, and I'll start with this. I'm thinking about paratext a lot these days as I work on my other monograph, but it starts with a note on translation. And I'll talk more about translation. Maybe you have questions about that too, so we can talk more about that. But I'll just say it starts with a note on translation and acknowledgements. Because again, as I said, this book, vis-a-vis acknowledgements, is really a collaboration. And one that I owe to not only Amit Ambalal and his family, really, but my dear friend Pulami Shah and brilliant designer who helped with this book, and to the folks at Mappin and many other conversation partners, Pushti Margi Vaishnavas and hereditary leaders, Goswamis. So it starts there. And then the book is opened really formally with a foreword by Amit Ambalal, who gives some of his own sort of perspectives on this manuscript and a little bit more broadly on the traditions of painting in the Pushtimarg. And for those who are listening and interested, his beautiful book, Krishna as Srinathji, which came out, I believe, in the late 90s and is still available and in circulation, is a wonderful study of Pushtimarg painting. So do look there for further details and details on technical things in painting in the Pushtimarg. His foreword is followed by my own brief introduction, which I've tried to make available to lots of different kinds of readers. So there's some technical details, really historical details, but really I hope that the introduction offers an invitation into the world of this this manuscript, but the Chorasi Vaishnava and Kivartha as a text more broadly. So that introduction, for instance, talks a little bit about the contours of the narratives themselves, how they are each very distinct and interesting, but also somewhat formulaic in that, for instance, they describe very often the process by which each of these Vaishnavas, each of these figures whose life stories are told, are first introduced to the Pushtimarg, are first initiated formally through formal acts of initiation into the community, how they meet Vallabhacharya, the preceptor, their guru, and most importantly, how they begin to practice seva, this form of loving worship, through singing songs, through preparing special food items, etc., for Krishna. So the introduction really tries to give the broader context of how these stories operate, but really focusing in on seva. Again, we can talk more about that as our conversation unfolds. And I say a bit more about the manuscript itself, its provenance, as we discussed briefly. And then the body of the text really is excerpts from these different Varthas. And you'll see, and people will notice, how do I write it? I have to even look here. I say from the Vartha of such and such individual, because these are just selections. Some of them represent what might be a complete Vartha, one complete story, but very often it's just one selection. And I've tried to choose in, I think it's 27, just shy of 30 different selections from the broader text, stories that correspond to the images in clear ways, and that also give the viewer a sense of the diversity of images, of illustrations that appear in the book. So the translations, again, excerpts from the larger text, and they often have some notes as well, so I sort of frame them a little bit for the reader. But they're very brief vignettes of what are already, relatively speaking, brief stories. And then the book ends with a sort of index of all of the very small images. Maybe somebody might need a magnifying glass to see them very well, but they are there. You can see all the images from the 85 images. There are 85 total illustrations, that is, in the book, and even includes pictures of the manuscript pages without illustrations that correspond to some of the stories that omit illustrations, because some of the narratives have three or four and some have none. So that's an interesting sort of quirk about this text. And then I have a glossary, because again, I want this book to be available to different types of readers. So some of the rather technical devotional terms are described in the glossary. So that's the book.
Now, why is seva so important, do you think? Going on with seva here?
Seva is really at the heart in my reading, and of course mine is one in conversation with lots of people over lots of time doing research, but in my reading of this text and of the Pushtimarg more broadly, seva is central because it is that tool through which to have intimate encounters with Krishna. The goal of the Pushtimargi devotee. So seva is in the Vartas, in these texts, is somewhat idiosyncratic. There's not a very clear list of things that one must do. You know, generally speaking, there's the narratives rather discuss sort of prescribe things like bathing before starting one's ritual practices, and preparing certain kinds of food items like this. But the Vartas are very clear that these practices have to be flexible. They have to be malleable. They have to be based on the means and the social contexts of each devotee, him or herself. So they really, Seva is really about sort of bridging the otherworldly world of Krishna, his lila, his divine play, with the very mundane, everyday worlds of the diversity of figures that we see represented in this text. So Seva is this sort of link, this bridge, this set of practices that brings the devotee in relationship to their beloved deity.
Lovely. Now, these 27 vignettes that you dive into and narrate and explicate, I mean, there's so much there. Are there ones that stand out to you most, that gripped you the most, that intrigued you the most?
You know, sometimes it's hard to choose. And every time I come back to the text, I sort of find new beauty and curiosities, humor. I mentioned humor in the narratives again and again. But I suppose that the ones that I highlight in the introduction of the book do speak to some of my favorite, if I can use that word, narratives, those that I just keep returning to again and again. So there's this one about a woman who doesn't have a proper name. And in fact, many of the devotees aren't given formal names. They're such and such woman from this place or that place. And here she's sort of designated by this broad caste designation, the Kshatriya woman, right? This one, so I offer the episode both in the introduction, and it's also translated more broadly in the body of the text, about a woman who has become sort of destitute through, she's a widow, and she spins cotton to make money, to feed herself, but really namely to feed her what's called a svarup, a form of Krishna that she keeps in her own home. So many of these devotees in the stories are bestowed with these living icons, really, of Krishna that they care for, that they feed. And feeding is so important. I could talk about food so much. Anyway, the story talks about how with whatever money she makes from her spinning as this single widowed woman, she goes to buy food for, you know, really I should read part of it, Raj. Do you think I should do that? May I read part of it?
Absolutely.
Okay, so let me read. I won't read the whole thing, but I'll read a part of it. So for those who have the book or are looking, this is on page 31 of my introduction. So the Vartas, I should say, have episodes. They're called prasangs, sort of little peaks into little into these lives. So this is the first prasang, the first episode. And I should say the image corresponds with the story, and I'll sort of pause when I get to that moment and talk about it. So here's the story. After some time, the woman ran out of money, became destitute. After completing seva for her Krishna Swarup, she would spin cotton and sell it to support herself. Whenever the vegetable seller would come by the house of the woman, Sri Thakurji, this is a sort of a name for Krishna, an epithet for Krishna, would call out. He would speak, "Oh Ma, the vegetable lady has come. Go get me something." Then the woman would go and buy a small amount of everything. Similarly, when the fruit seller would come, Thakurji would say, "Oh Ma, go fetch me some fruit." Even then, if she had only a little bit of money, the woman would buy a variety of fruit for Thakurji. After observing this woman's behavior, the fruit and vegetable seller came to suspect that the woman would not allow her darling son out of the house because she feared he would be given the evil eye. "If this lady comes to buy from my cart first thing in the morning," thought the vegetable seller, "then I'll surely be lucky in my sales throughout the day. I'll wait beside her door each day until she comes to buy from the cart." Indeed, the old woman would come daily and purchase all types of items. Now, I just love this part. Cucumbers, spinach, and all types of greens and other fresh items. These little details about the food that is purchased. From these items, she would lovingly prepare food to offer Thakurji. One day, when the vegetable lady was passing by the woman's home, Thakurji ran out of the house and called, "Come quick, my mother is coming. Go fetch me something." The lady heard the beautiful voice and came running, but Takuruji quickly went back inside the house and was never seen. "My darling, you mustn't run outside like that. You'll be given the evil eye," the woman scolded Takuruji. "But the vegetable lady was about to leave. How would you get me anything? How would you feed me?" he responded. And they continued arguing like this, right? And then this is very sweet part. Krishna, Takuruji says to her, "Just like a worldly child, well, how will you feed me? How will you feed me my meal?" The woman assured Takuruji, telling him that she would get vegetables from another vendor or from the bazaar. "Don't argue with me. Just be content," she says. Then, and this is the part that corresponds to the image, like a small child, Takuruji climbed up on the woman's shoulders and whined. "But when will you bring me my food?" In this way, Takuruji bestowed much grace on the woman. So the image doesn't quite show Takuruji climbing on her shoulders, but you can see the woman sitting in front of this childlike figure that is Krishna here. And he sort of has his hands on her knee. Now, I have a toddler myself. So just the sort of the way in which this is so human and down to earth and funny, really. But also it's really depicting this amazingly intimate, blessed, graced relationship that this woman has. It's just a beautiful story. I always come back to this.
Well, there's such an emphasis on lived embodied experience, everything from how ornate and luscious and beautiful the images are, to the vignettes you see about cucumbers and a whining toddler, not even a toddler, young child. And, you know, there's just, I keep coming back to this idea of imminence and tangibility. Mm-hmm. And, one of these beautiful Krishnite images that comes to mind when I read many of these is Yashoda scolding Krishna for eating dirt.
That's right.
Him being like any kid who wants to avoid judgment or punishment, he fibs about it and just says, "Open your mouth." And then through that immediacy, that imminence, she's brought into this cosmic realm of this abyss that she can't comprehend.
Put it back.
Eat all the dirt you want. I'm done.
That's right. She can't handle that, right? It's her child. And in fact, I opened the introduction with a story just like that and comparing it to the sort of Vishvarupa episode from the Gita, right? Where Arjun sort of asks to see Krishna in his sort of Vishvarupa in the form of forms, right? But then can't handle it quite, wants him to come back to this human form. So there's the sense that even in these very distinct stories that are really specific to the Pushti Marg, that Krishna is related to, of course, Krishna as a deity that transcends this community, of course, in this time frame, one that is always both of the world and beyond the world at once. So, yeah.
Beautiful. Are there any other vignettes that you wanted to comment on or share? Or really anything about the book that you wanted to share?
Well, I will say a word about translation eventually, but let me see what else I can. There are so many, it's hard to choose from.
I make the crude analogy at times, but purposefully crude, that, you know, it's like picking favorites among your children, right?
That's right. I won't read another one, but there's a very short one. This is from the Bharata of Rukmini, and this is a daughter of another Vaishnava who appears in the text, and I think her whole family really has their story told. And sum up here, although this image is just so beautiful. She is in Benares. She has traveled to Benares from her home elsewhere to bathe, not herself, but her svarup, her icon, her living icon of Krishna in the sacred waters of the Ganges, of the Ganga. And she there encounters the son of Vallabhacharya, the son of this community's preceptor, who is in his own right a great teacher of the community. And he asks to speak with her. He's there with other disciples at the river's edge himself. He says to her, when's the last time you came here to Benares to bathe yourself? She said, well, I haven't bathed in 24 years, which is how old she is. And he, you wouldn't quite get this unless you really know. She says this because she has been so, and actually the Vartha requires a little bit of explanation from the commentator whose work is also included in this. And I'll say more about that in a minute, but 24 years have gone by since she thought about the cleansing of her own body, because she's been just focused on her icon of Krishna and cleansing him and bathing him in the water. So it's just this beautiful, again, this idea, and also supposed to be funny though, right? That these devotees get so lost in their other world of devotion that sometimes they forget about themselves. So, and the picture, the image, is just so, so beautiful. Of Sri Gusainji, this is how he's called, Brittalnachi, another name for the son of Vallabhacharya, sitting at the banks of the Ganges, doing his pranayam with his disciples, who are much smaller in stature than him. This is always the case, that Vallabhacharya and Gusainji are shown as great teachers to be larger in stature. With Rukmini, this woman, at his side, he's seated beneath a tree. I don't know that there's a tree growing on the ghats of the Ganges, but very often these teachers are shown beneath a tree, the chonkar tree, which is meant to be mitigate the heat and power of their bodies from basically burning the ground. So it sort of neutralizes their seated there. Anyway, I could go on about the details, but really one has to see them in person.
Absolutely. And if one didn't glean from the narrative that he was larger than life, then certainly from the image.
That's right. That's exactly right.
From the visual storytelling.
That's exactly right.
Larger than life.
Yeah.
A couple points come to
sure.
mind. Which one first? Yeah, you mentioned in passing just now this commentator. Like, what do you mean? What's a commentator, and what are you looking at here?
Right. So there are different recensions of this text beyond this one manuscript, some that circulate with this very popular embedded commentary called the Bhav Prakash, the sort of illumination of the text's inner meaning. This word Bhav can mean many things, but that's how I might translate it here. And it's attributed to another descendant of Vallabhacharya, Hari Raiji. And that's the recension that this manuscript is based on. And it's actually very close to other manuscripts that come out of this recension, and even to those later printed editions that are based on those manuscripts, which actually made it a bit easier to read through some of the more difficult to read parts of the text if they had been, for instance, not preserved well and the writing was blurred. But the commentary, what does it do? It basically anticipates readers' questions. There's one thing, it does several things. It anticipates questions that readers might have. And in one sense, it acts in a very modern way, or contemporary way, I should say, because sometimes the questions that the commentator might ask, like, reader, you must be thinking this. I think, well, I really was thinking that. Like, how did you know that? So it's kind of interpreting some of the let's say, more dense philosophical points that these sort of down-to-earth stories are trying to illuminate from Vallabhacharya's much broader set of teachings, mostly in Sanskrit. So the commentator might, for instance, say, well, here, this story illuminates the teaching that Vallabhacharya has given in such and such treatise about this, let's say, point about humility or self-sacrifice. So it does that. It also does this really beautiful thing where it places these very, again, worldly, down-to-earth, sometimes rough around the edges figures in the broader context of Krishna's lila, his divine play. So very often the story itself will begin with this part of the commentary, which says this earthly figure corresponds to this divine counterpart of Krishna and his other counterparts in the eternal world of Braj, and has come to earth as this human form. So these figures, when we meet them, are already placed as sort of divine and otherworldly, with counterparts in Krishna's eternal realm. So I'll just give one example. Vallabhacharya himself is none other. His divine counterpart is Radha, is Krishna's beloved, known as Swaminiji in these stories. So that's how that commentary works. And it's sort of blended into the stories in such a way that for readers who are familiar with these recensions, it's just sort of part and parcel of the text.
That's great. very recently, I had on the podcast Macamas Taylor. He's a scholar of the Puranas at Australian National University. And he just finished a translation, a blank verse translation of the entire Vishnu Purana. It's the second time in nearly 200 years. Wow. Nearly 200 years ago was the first and last time it was translated into English. And I remember having this moment. Thank goodness that I mute when my guests speak, so listeners aren't distracted by my giggles and my gasps and my God knows what. All favorable, of course. But this moment where, you know, I had him kind of unpack. So, you know, what's that translation process like? And he very humbly said, you know, the unlike the Bhagavata, for example, the Vishnu Purana is in basic Sanskrit that even I can understand. And you know, in this moment, talking about the commentators, he was like, the commentators basically they clarify certain words in certain contexts. And what he said was, for people like me who are translating the text, and had this moment where it was like that the Edic Emic divide just collapsed in that moment, because he was like, the commentator, their efforts are for people like me.
That's right.
That's beautiful. It's brilliant.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All that as a long-winded and hopefully colorful bridge to this question about translation.
Yes.
How does that work for you?
Well, it is. I'll just say first the translation, and then I'm sure you and so many listeners and others you've interviewed here have this experience too, that it's one of the most delightful but also challenging parts of my work. And I would say, to me, the sort of first and foremost rule of thumb as a translator, I've been doing this for many years, but I still count myself as a novice in many ways, is to be able to be flexible enough that I can both engage very, very deeply at the level where I might, you know, spend weeks trying to figure out what one word means and the context for it. So very, very closely, learning the unique ecology of the text. I think I'm borrowing the phrase from the eminent late scholar A.K. Ramanujan, to learn the unique ecology, but also to be able to move myself far enough away that I'm not sort of bound to the text so much that I feel somehow unable to move beyond. There's no such thing as a literal translation, but as literal as possible a translation as one could give. Because especially, and of course, every piece of literature, every text is so different to translate. But this text, these are storytelling texts that, as I said, have this amazing sort of oral residue to them. They're meant to be read aloud. And if I get too literal, I lose the flavor of the text. I lose the tone, some of the humor. And even as I sort of say this, I realize how impossible it is to sort of, you know, to do that. But I do my best to work through the text as closely as I can, to really get into the nitty-gritty sort of details of each word, but then really to move away from it and to try to bring across the flavor, the affect to my readers.
Yeah, we've touched on this theme a number of times before. I think also with Macamas Taylor recently, but also last year with Archana Venkatesan, phenomenal translator.
Phenomenal, yes.
And this sort of this hybrid entity that is scholarly translation of narrative or poetic works, where you need your gears working well to understand precisely as best you can what the word means, what the case ending in Sanskrit is, whatever it would have meant in that day, all that stuff. Right. And yet, just moving that, like converting, as you're converting currency from one to another language, you miss the whole purpose of all the, the purpose of it is to point to a meaning, a sense, a flavor.
Exactly.
The purpose is to point. And it's sort of this, you have to be really out there, probably when I would qualify for that, to aim to render something in a different language, in a different culture, in a different time, mindful of the flavor, this je ne sais quoi,
yes,
this ineffable thing that you're trying to translate, that's palpable to anybody who can discern it. And then you have to sort of, you know, one thing that's come up a number of times when talking about this is some people have other people involved where they'll share verses.
Absolutely.
With members of their family, perhaps. And I wonder, what was that like for you? Like, what was the actual process like? Like, would you come up with a
wonderful
verse?
Wonderful question. Right.
Would you share it?
Right. So this is, you know, prose. And I started reading these texts. Actually, the first time I learned about them was through Rupert Snell. Rupert Snell was one of my wonderful mentors at University of Texas at Austin, a great scholar, as many listeners know, of Brajbhasha literature. And his, I don't remember a publication date, but 1990s classical Hindi, or reader in classical Hindi is what he called it, sort of not only talks about the structure and history of Brajbhasha, grammar, etc., but gives sort of selected translations and readings. And so he included in that reader some excerpts of these vartas. So I sort of learned myself, I first learned about these texts through that reader, and first read these texts with Rupert Snell as a graduate student in Austin. So he was my first conversation partner. And so even some of the, I can't remember now, but some of the selections I have in this book, probably I first read and tried to start translating as a graduate student at UT Austin. But really the process when it came down to refining it for these texts was to kind of go through somewhat literal translations and then to sort of carry them with me. This book, as many books, of course, had a long gestation period. So as I was back in India doing back and forth from the US to India doing research, each of these stories that I've translated here, I had conversations about with those who read them every day. And nearly every single one of them, I had questions about particular words, what they meant, words that meant, I knew meant certain things in the context of this, of Seva, for instance, that did not resonate with any of the meanings that I, you know, found in dictionaries, etc. So the process of translation is one of conversation, ethnographic research, and then again, moving far enough away that I can really sort of try to bring out the humor, the flavor, the affect. So many, many, many drafts, even for these very small selections. Yeah.
It's nice to see. It's probably interesting for folks to get a peek behind the curtain, so to speak, and see, you know, what happens to get the show on. There's one thing I want to touch on that's not directly related to research, but I think it's probably innate to this type of work. And that is the relationship between, in the South Asian context, right? The relationship, arguably everywhere, but especially in South Asia, the relationship between storytelling and pedagogy and teaching. And there was, I can't remember when, this might've been 2018. I edited a volume for online magazine of the AAR, Religious Studies News. That's what it is. And it was called something like Harnessing the Power of Storytelling in the Hindu Studies Classroom. The extent to which teaching Hindu stories is teaching Hinduism in many ways. Could you say a bit about that? I don't want to put words into your mouth, but sort of generate a bit of conversation. Could you say a bit about that connection with the work, with this work?
Yeah, that's so interesting that you asked that, because I really, the first time I actually ever used my own research in my teaching was just this past spring. And I assigned some of the introduction and several selections of these stories to my students. And actually they corresponded to our reading of the Gita. And I wanted them to sort of, we learned about Krishna later in the semester as well, but I wanted them to, even in their introduction to Krishna through the Gita, to get a sense of how diverse this deity was and all the sort of registers of texts that are devoted to him. It was, it became a really wonderful reminder that that my work and these translations here are very much part of not only the practice of storytelling in the Pushtimari community itself, but a wonderful sort of tool for teaching my students, right, for introducing them to how stories function in people's everyday lives, and in text. So, but more broadly, Raj, I mean, really, I think you're right, that so much of my teaching of South Asian religions in the classroom revolves around stories. I mean, sometimes,
And the stories being so consciously didactic.
Oh, right? Absolutely, yes. I mean, this is one of the funny things is, you know, when I first started studying this community, spending time with folks in this community, they said, "Oh, well, of course it makes sense that you're studying these hagiographies, because if you're just learning, this is a great place to start. They'll teach you everything you need to know," which of course is only partly true, because anything, not that I know much, but everything I know comes from the conversations about these stories with people as they are living texts. But absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, but right there, you point to another piece there, like the web of the storytelling of the text and the life stories drawing on the text. It's lived experience.
That's
so
right.
It's beautiful.
That's right.
Is there anything else that you wanted to touch on pertaining to your book?
Well, I could certainly go on and on, but I'll just say one other really important thing. Perhaps especially to those who do know about this community more broadly or have read about it before, is that so much wonderful scholarship, but so much scholarship that has been published on the Pushtimark focuses, and not wrongly, on the sort of illustrious heritage of the Goswamis, of the hereditary leaders descending from Vallabhacharya, this first preceptor of the 16th century, their Sanskrit treatises, and their lives. And these narratives, and so much really how these narratives in this manuscript, as they are highlighted by these paintings, these narratives and these paintings really focus on domestic worship, and the that includes men and women. And so we get to see this amazing sort of peek into at least how the artists and authors here, the scribes, storytellers, saw everyday lives of men and women in their homes. And that's really distinct. I think that's really unique, something unique about the text and about this manuscript that I would love people to notice as they think about this this text in terms of Pushtimargi studies, a sort of very small niche world, but the domestic quality of Seva and how all different types of figures, men and women, are represented.
Well, I'm glad you're also speaking to, and that's the intrigue about this podcast. I never know if it's for the specialist or the generalist. It seems to be for both, as well as the continuing studies crowd. Say a quick word to close about who would certainly be interested in this book. Who's the book for?
Yeah, wonderful question. Who's the book for? Really, the book is meant to attract as wide an audience as possible. And really, the book is, I have heard both from scholars and specialists and from folks from the Pushtimargi community. And the latter, those who I've heard from, I would say I sort of privilege here in this publication, in the sense that, I so value these podcasts, because I really do think that folks will listen to and engage with scholarly work, academic work, that perhaps is less available through monographs themselves sometimes, right? But I really, to hearing from folks, Pushtimargi Vaishnavas, who have shared this book perhaps with younger family members, children who don't read or haven't had interest in reading Braj Bhasha or even Gujarati or Hindi translations, but have engaged with the English translations here of these texts, has been really exciting to me. So this book is for those folks especially, but really for anybody who is interested in the very distinct way that pictures tell stories in this pre-modern context. Yeah.
Thank you very much for appearing on the podcast today.
Raj, thank you so much. It's been really, really wonderful to speak with you.
My pleasure. For those of you listening, we've been speaking with Dr. Amelia Bachrach, assistant professor at Oberlin, about her new, rich, beautiful book, In the Service of Krishna. You'll have links for the book in the podcast notes, as well as links pertaining to the upcoming American Academy of Religion panel that she's chairing, featuring works that are also featured on the podcast. Until next time, stay safe, stay sane, keep listening. They keep telling me to do this, but I keep forgetting. I'm on Twitter at Dr. Raj Balkran. There you go. I joined Twitter last year, mainly for the podcast. Stay safe, stay sane, keep listening, and keep contemplating the Leela of Krishna. Take care.